This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Oh, it is indeed. And if you're looking for the quicker recap of this, you're getting it right here. If you want a longer, more detailed recap, we're going to have that on the channel as well. In fact, it's probably up by now. But April 28th, 2025, day five of the Karen Reed trial kind of feels like day 55.
Yeah.
Because this thing,
yes,
it's intense. And it's been a lot to see, honestly. It's been very interesting thus far. It's far from being predictable. The day five began with what's become an all too familiar routine. Tensions high, the courtroom thick with anticipation, and a strange calm seemed to settle as a digital forensic expert, Ian Whiffen, took the stand, but his testimony was anything but boring. Whiffen isn't here to talk about whether patterns or simple phone calls. No, he is here to dissect the very data that may hold the key to unlocking what happened that night to Boston police officer John O'Keefe, the night he died. Spoiler alert! It's a lot more complicated than just the simple phone ping. Do you watch
any? Can I interject something here?
Yeah.
To our listeners, I want to say I learned something today.
That you like men with accents of whatever his accent was?
Yeah, it was cute. It's really cute.
Yeah.
He sounds extremely intelligent. He could read the phone book and it would sound great. If there's not phone books really anymore. But that point aside, the things that we learn about your cell phone.
Oh, yeah.
Astounding. I thought I knew what cell phones could do.
Mm-hmm.
This guy opened it up and showed us basically that, like, for example, if you have an iPhone, it knows when it's in a pocket.
Yeah.
It, because the camera is sensing light.
Mm-hmm.
So it knows when you take it out of a pocket. The battery temperature is always being tracked.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are things, maybe on a hot day, you're getting a notification, at least I do on my phone, especially if I'm out kayaking on a, you know, 95 degree day, phone is too hot.
Yeah.
And it'll take its power level down because it's getting too warm. Well, these phones are always tracking different data set points. Yeah. They're looking at, is there a face nearby that I can try to recognize? Is there light coming into the camera? Is the battery too hot? Is it on the move?
Yeah.
There's all these different things that it's doing. It's listening to you all the time.
Mm-hmm. It is. It was kind of creepy. He was detailed. I mean, there's times where it got a little boring, but for the most part, he kept it going. And he was revealing a lot of stuff about, you know, what type of data you can get. And the big thing of this was, really kind of twofold here, to try and figure out the hows long to die in cold and explain it by the people who wrote the program on how this works, not just an investigator interpreting what they get. He's a forensic examiner of these things. He knows what he's doing, and he has no skin in the game here. He's just talking about how these things work. So we learned again today, and you know, the Free Karen Reed folks, they're not going to accept it, but he again showed today how that was searched for later in the morning. It was not done at 2 something. It was done much later in the morning. It was like 6 or 5, whenever the time is they found him is when that was searched, because it made sense, because Karen Reed was talking to the paramedic. How long does it take for him to die in the cold? So you have Jen McCabe going, look that up too. It's logical. It's logical. Otherwise, you're talking about a very illogical thing where you have all of these people drunk and in the middle of the night conspiring to hide a death or a murder of them killing a cop in their house. And somehow everyone is in on it. Nobody's ever going to talk or lie or make anything up or spill the beans. It's so improbable. It's so improbable. And I don't know how you go down the road that that's what happened. I just don't. it would be shocking if this is a conspiracy. And now, is there problems with the police? Yes, of course there is.
Yeah.
But does the truth lie in that he got beat up in the house? No. Does the truth lie in that Karen Reed didn't hit him? I don't know. And that's the thing with this case. I don't know. There's starting to be a lot of evidence, more than I thought in the past, pointing to consciousness of guilt, pointing to like she knows something's wrong with John, and leaves. You know, well, at least according to her, she didn't think he had, you know, he wasn't mortally wounded, which is a weird thing to say.
I've never said that about anybody.
No. And then why would you be saying that? Again, I don't think this was intent. I don't think, but I think when you get second degree murder is when you leave the person and they're stumbling around, or you didn't see them get into the car. You willingly into the house. You willingly are leaving because you're like, you know, screw that. They're going to be fine. You're not thinking, I just, you know, killed him, because I'm guessing he was moving around a bit at that moment in time. We also learned today from the Cellbright guys that John didn't move. He wasn't in the house. His phone is pinging from the front yard.
Yep.
The only pings are from the front yard. For those of you who missed it, Whiffen's job is to make sense of all those complicated little breadcrumbs our phones have left behind. It's like tracking a ghost through the modern world, except the ghost just been hit by a car, or maybe not. O'Keefe's phone, yes, the one that registered all that cold, lonely data in the dead of night, was supposed to tell a tale, and it did, but the stories got more twists than a thriller novel. Whiffen calmly explained that O'Keefe's phone arrived at 34 Fairview Road at exactly 12:24 a.m., and then nothing. The phone stayed right there in front of the house, not moving an inch from that moment until the body was discovered hours later. And they got that from multiple pings. What's going on down there, buddy?
What's happening?
Furball.
Aw.
You good? I was like, okay. Buddy, I can't pick him up. He's a large dog. I'd show you him. He's a border collie. But yeah,
sorry, bud.
It's okay, bud. He looks like he's fine. All right. Continuing on after the furball, from that moment until the body was discovered hours later, the temperature of the phone battery drops. Okay. It's ticking down like a clock, counting down to the seconds. Something bad is going to happen. Whiffen paints the picture with every data point, turning the phone into a silent witness. It stays cold. So the phone didn't move. It was a complete lack of the movement after 12:24 a.m. The phone was there. O'Keefe, not so much. You can almost feel the room's collective gasp when Whiffen drops another bomb. That weirdly timed Google search about how long it takes to die in the cold. Yeah, not what the defense thought. The time step made it look like Jennifer McCabe had searched for that dark question at 2:27 a.m., well before O'Keefe's body was found. But no, Whiffen carefully debunked it. Turns out McCabe didn't search that until much later, around 6:23 a.m., after the body was discovered, not before. The earlier timestamp, it was a quirk of how browsers record open tabs. It's what's been, you know. But again, if you don't want to believe an expert, you're never going to believe this. I'm going with the facts on this one. This guy is not part of the Canton PD or any of the, he's an independent guy. I don't know how you don't just believe some facts here, but it is what it is. So again, does it prove that Karen Reed hit him or killed him? No, but it shows he didn't go into the house and get beat up there.
I wonder, Tony, if we can pair up, and we are not defense attorneys or prosecutors, but can they pair up the car's data to the phone and overlap them and see, did the car go in reverse?
Oh, that's coming up.
Close to the time where the phone ended up where it landed?
That's coming up.
Yeah.
Yep. Because they have far more data info on the vehicle now too.
They may be able to prove that something happened between the phone and the car, and a body got in the way.
Well, it's funny because that's what everybody knows, or that the body got. I don't know if they can show that, but we're going to see because they have sensors too, and impact sensors. So we're going to see if there's an impact sensor that was triggered on this car. But what they're basically doing is disproving the made up story that he went in the house. A story, you know, that, so, okay. And if you don't have that story, if they never went down that road, it would just be Karen out there. Like, and she's the last one who saw him. So I think that's a much easier argument to make, but you're going down this road of he got beat up in the house and that, and you can be proved wrong on that. Then no one else is going to trust anything else you have to say. So I think this whole house story is insane. I don't think it benefits Karen Reed at all. And it should have been looked at very differently. But again, I don't know that second degree murder charges should have ever been made either. So we have the cross-examination by defense attorney Robert Alessi. Alessi isn't letting it go. He's trying to poke holes, questioning every aspect of Whiffen's analysis. But here's the thing. No matter how hard he pushes, Whiffen stays cool. Laying down the facts like it's just another day in the office. No, the phone didn't move. No, the health data doesn't suggest O'Keefe entered the house. Yes, O'Keefe's device likely stayed out in the cold, the kind of cold that chills you to your core. The courtroom then took a break for lunch. The real fireworks happened after the jury left. The afternoon session was a whole other animal. We're dealing with expert witnesses, and enter Dr. Daniel Wolf and Dr. Andrew Rechner, defense experts from ARCA. The crash reconstruction gurus. These guys are supposed to back up Reed's claim that O'Keefe wasn't hit by her vehicle. But their credentials and connections, well, that's where things get a little more murky. Here's the deal. Wolf, who was hired by the Department of Justice originally, has been doing some real dance moves with the defense team. Texts, phone calls were exchanged, and oops, some of those messages mysteriously vanished. Wolf admitted he deleted his text routinely, and when asked why he used Signal, an encrypted messaging app, he had some interesting reasons. Apparently, after the first trial, Wolf got some undesirable attention online, and the defense advised him to protect himself. So using Signal was all about safety and, you know, confidentiality.
Signal has been in the news as of late.
Yeah. So
it can be hacked.
Yeah. And let's not forget the kicker here. Wolf couldn't keep track of his communication with the defense, deleted texts, phone calls, emails, things that should have been turned over to the prosecution, but somehow weren't. Wolf insists it's all just a big misunderstanding. He was just doing his job, folks. A classic case of nothing to see here, except when the prosecution points out how convenient all of it is, the room starts to feel a little bit bigger. Now, it could be a coincidence. It really could be. Could is the operative word. Dr. Yeah. Rechner, his colleague, didn't have much time on the stand, but he managed to land a few bombs of his own. He, too, admits to receiving some handy information from the DOJ during the first trial, something that might have been against the rules. Apparently, no one bothered to mention sequestration orders to those crash experts. So they got a sneak peek into what other witnesses were saying. Nice. And just like that, the clock winds down for the day. The damage is done. The defense is scrambling to patch things up in some of those holes. And we'll see where it all lands as questions will continue tomorrow in the trial of Karen Reed. It's a fascinating one.
It is. And they are poking so many holes in what the defense is claiming. Mm-hmm. It's not looking good. And I mean, my gut feeling is this is not going to go well for her.
I feel like at the end of the day, we're going to end up with the manslaughter with count two.
I think so, too.
I don't think you're going to get second degree murder. I just don't. I think there's evidence there that points to she was conscious that he was outside. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that
she knew something.
But I don't know that she was conscious that he was that mortally injured. That's the thing. I think she's accurate in what she said. He didn't look mortally wounded, because I think if she looked back, maybe didn't even know she hit him. if she did, and saw him stumbling around and thought he's drunk. You know, he does this all the time where he's pouring extra shots and drinks, as she says, and walking around and taking the cup to other places. So she's, they're all probably used to this, I don't know, drunken behavior, and thought, oh, you know, he's going to walk it off and get into the house. I think that could be very reasonable on this.
Now, is that being a responsible friend? She's not on trial for that, but I mean, well, at the end of the day, you should really make sure that your friend slash boyfriend slash husband slash significant other gets to their location safely.
Well, in later stories, she did.
True.
In later stories, she did.
Yeah, the stories do keep changing, don't they?
Oh, my God. Yeah.
Change more than your underwear.
Yeah. Thankfully, there's an Unsolved Mysteries episode on our channel now with Robert Stack and Karen Reed. And it's quite the show. It gets into the case. And what time we got here? I think maybe
is it Wicked Smart?
I think maybe we should watch a little bit of Unsolved Mysteries.
Do we need popcorn? You never give us warning to get our popcorn ready. Would you kind of pay attention to that, please?
Yeah, I'll think about it more next time. There's also please a long do. Distance dedication from Casey Kaser from Karen to her bartender. That's out there too. Things I do in my weekend is basically what this is all about. So here we go. We're going to go back in time. This is satire. This is not real, kids. And some things have been embellished because it's comedy. It's quite the episode. So let's move this over here and we'll watch it together.
Pardon me while I make sure I don't have to run to the basement. We're under tornado stuff.
Are you under a warning?
Nope, not yet. I thought we were.
All right.
We're good. We're good for another 20 minutes.
I would say if you were, that's just tough. You have to
tough it out. Okay.
Tough it out. We're on the air.
All right.
It's just like we were covering severe weather.
Like in radio when you had the flu and they'd hand you a waste paper basket and go here.
or severe weather. I mean, that was, you know, that's basically the same sort of thing too there. Where it was just, okay, well, that's great. But we got to cover this. And
yeah.
All right, here we go.
You'll die.
Unsolved Mysteries. Let's watch.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries, how many weak vodka tonics, how many desperate shots does it take to make one real drink? For Karen Reed, the answer remains as elusive as the truth itself. Somewhere between missing memories, shifting stories, and four bonus shots, the line between sobriety and disaster disappeared.
Good Lord, Tony. You know, I was going to say we need to get you a girlfriend, but I think I'm...
A snowy night in Massachusetts.
I showed this to my girlfriend.
A respected yesterday. Police officer. And a woman whose recollection of the evening is about as stable as her blood alcohol content. Officer John O'Keefe went out for a night of celebration. Hours later, he was found battered and frozen. A few yards from a house full of people who swear they saw... nothing. At the center of the mystery, his girlfriend, Karen Reed, a woman whose timeline changes more often than the specials board at the Waterfall Bar. Oh, first, God. Karen claimed she dropped John off safely and watched him walk bravely into the house, probably. Then she remembered she didn't actually see him go inside because she left before the ending. Or maybe he poked his head through the door like a shy raccoon and then evaporated. Or maybe... and this is important. He didn't look mortally wounded when she sped away.
He didn't look mortally wounded as far as I could see, but could I have done something that knocked him out and in drunkenness and in the cold didn't come to again?
And this would have been the moment you dropped him off at the party.
Yeah, thinking. Yeah.
As investigators searched for answers, one question remained. Did Karen Reed know more than she was willing to admit?
I don't know. What if I ran his foot over or what if I clipped him in the knee and he passed out and or went to care for himself and he threw up or passed out? And David said, yeah, then you have some element of culpability.
At first, Karen suggested she was simply confused.
I said, could I have hit him? Did I hit him?
How could that have been? I mean, you dropped him off at the house.
I don't know what else could have been. It was howling wind. I had YouTube blasting on the stereo. And I thought, did he somehow try to flag me down, which was the reaction I was hoping to garner as I slowly pulled away from the house? Did he come out and maybe trip or bend over to pick up his cell phone and I ran over his foot and then he passed out drunk? I mean, I didn't think I hit him, but could I have clipped him? Could I have tagged him in the knee and incapacitated him?
A panicked girlfriend asking a heartbreaking question.
It's kind of to the point that I even wonder, did I even say the word hit at all? I've just been told it from the beginning, and I know what I thought it, like, could I be responsible? Because I don't know what the hell happened. So, yeah, if anything, I said, could I have? Because I have I did question that in the early innings. But now I'm like, Jesus, did I even say hit?
But as time went on, her explanation grew more complicated.
My memory is not as sharp when I drink as it is when I don't. But I don't black out. I don't wake up and say I can't remember anything from the night before. So there's no part of me that thinks I hit John. I know I didn't hit John.
And then this shit.
Could I be responsible? Because I don't know what the hell happened.
And that shit.
I remember everything. I said, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? And I'm not as clear as I would be if I hadn't been drinking. I mean, I had drank, so, and that led me to question, like, could I have hit him? Did I run over his foot or hit him in the knee? Did I incapacitate him?
And this shit, too, for good measure.
And she tells me that John didn't come home, they got into a fight, and that she left him at the waterfall. And I say, Karen, we saw you outside of my sister's.
And what was her response?
She told me that she didn't remember going there. And then she started yelling, Jen. And then she was saying, did I hit him? Could I have hit him?
And this is while you're still in your home and you're in your bed, correct?
Correct. And then she proceeded to say that she had a cracked taillight.
And that shit.
I remember everything. I may have said to Carrie, I'm worried he's dead or something. But I didn't say unequivocally in a declarative statement, Carrie, John's dead. And if I had killed him, why would I be saying that?
Soon the story evolved again.
He said, I'll run in. So when John got out of the car at Brian Albert's house, he took my full vodka soda, which is sitting in the cup holder. And he walked up the driveway, and John always walked, kind of skipped and walked at the same time. He was always in a rush. And I saw him reach the breezeway door, which is the side front door, and he opened the door and went to walk in. And I waited probably a minute, and he doesn't come. And it only took like 2 or 3 minutes that for me to be irritated. So I called him. I didn't want to wait for him to respond to a text, and he didn't answer. I said, you've got to be kidding me. What are you doing? You just went in and I'm sitting here. Either we're welcome or we're not, but it shouldn't take you 5 minutes to determine that. And then about 10 minutes went by, and I left, and I was not happy.
John, you are using me right now. You're a loser. Yourself.
And little did I know, John was not getting my phone calls. And then that was it. The last I ever talked to him was when he got out of my car at Brian Albert's house.
Each telling raised new questions and fewer answers. Yet despite her own uncertainty, Karen Reed's confidence would eventually return. And then this shit.
It's impossible for me to have any sympathy for any of these witnesses. Definitionally, is it harassing witnesses? Yes, they're witnesses against me in my prosecution. And is he yelling things at them? And is he going up to their front doors and ringing the bell? Yes. But they shouldn't be witnesses. They should have been suspects. So it's not cut and dry.
How Karen Reed first said she saw John get out of the car and walk toward the house. Then she said she didn't see him go in. Then she said he poked his head through the door and disappeared. Then she said she left before he even got out. Then she said she left him at the bar. She remembered feeling sick. Then she remembered feeling angry. Then she remembered feeling sick about being angry. Then she forgot all of it and remembered something completely different two interviews later. According to Karen Reed's memory, John O'Keefe was simultaneously inside the house, outside the house, halfway through the front door, trapped in a snowdrift, and possibly abducted by atmospheric conditions. And despite openly asking, "Did I hit him?" at the scene, Karen would later insist that she couldn't have possibly hit him because it was scientifically, emotionally, and spiritually impossible, according to her.
They say that I'm a drunk, vengeful girlfriend, scorned lover, but I'm innocent. I'm being set up, and these witnesses, they're all lying. I just can't wait to get our shot at these guys. It's going to be the game changer.
At this point, trying to follow Karen Reed's story is like trying to solve a murder inside a snow globe during an earthquake, blindfolded while drunk. Each time investigators thought they had the facts straight, Karen gave them a brand new version, gift-wrapped in vodka and denial.
And his mother leans over the kitchen island and says to me, "I think he looks like he got hit by a car. He looks like he got hit by a car." I'm like, "Wait a minute, were you both looking at the same body?"
Was it memory loss?
I said, "Could I have hit him? Did I hit him?
How could that have been? I mean, you dropped him off at the house."
I don't know what else could have been. It was howling wind. I had YouTube blasting on the stereo. And I thought, did he somehow try to flag me down, which was the reaction I was hoping to garner as I slowly pulled away from the house? Did he come out and maybe trip or bend over to pick up his cell phone and I ran over his foot?
Deception? Or simply the natural result of four vodka tonics, four bonus shots, and a breathtaking refusal to pick one timeline and stick to it?
This is my version of testifying. Doing this film is my testimony. This has happened to me.
Tonight, we ask not just what happened to John O'Keefe, but whether anyone, including Karen Reed herself, will ever figure out what night she's even trying to remember. If you could find your way into her mind, through the fog of vodka-soaked memories, the maze of shifting stories, and the thick walls of self-delusion, then perhaps you, too, could solve a mystery.
Wow. That is stunning.
There you go.
That is positively stunning. I'm not often speechless, but I'm not sure what to say.
That's what
Bravo,
I did this weekend.
Bravo, Tony. Bravo.
Oh, you got to hear the Casey Kasem one as well. That's out there on all of our social platforms. And there's an even longer one and a slightly different one on YouTube as well. It's fascinating, but it's comedy. It's satire. Those are not supposed to be real statements or anything. It's satire. So things have been embellished in those. But other things have not. But my God. So there you go. There'll be a lot more of that stuff. Tony at Tony B Pod is my Twitter or X or whatever the hell, if anybody wants to follow that. I also put up some interesting graphics today. A Choose Your Own Adventure Karen Reed book.
Oh, my God. How do you find the time?
Well, I'm just doing it in between other things, and my brain is just going nonstop on things about this. I'll pull the graphic up here. And obviously, if you're listening to this, you got to check out our YouTube page, and you can see all of these things or follow us on social media. Let me save this down here.
I'm in awe of your talent. When we work together in radio, we call like the jingles and things between songs, we call that imaging. And Tony was always an amazing, amazing guy at imaging.
Here you go, Karen.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Choose your own adventure.
This is like a book from childhood.
Yeah. Karen Reed, The Night of a Thousand Stories. And she's holding a vodka tonic.
And the house is in the background.
Yeah, it's a house in the background. Can you survive a night of missing memories and shifting timelines? Yeah, it looks just like the old Choose Your Own Adventure. Another creation today that I put out on the social media, a Nintendo game, Escape from Fairview Road.
Oh my God.
Let me.
You know, you might need to do your own YouTube channel of how to do some of this shit.
It's not hard.
Oh, shut up.
And I don't want to give away my secrets.
Well, I can understand that.
Not that there's many secrets here. This is just, I mean, it's with the help of AI.
It's not hard, because to the average person who has no clue where to even begin, it is hard.
It's hard to come up with the ideas.
No, the ideas are easy. It's the
no, the AI is easy to do this. The ideas are, because you got to think in kind of a weird way to come up with some of this shit.
You have to be half a bubble off, and we know that you are, and it works for you.
It's, so there you go. That's Escape from Fairview Road. And here's some product some screenshots from the back of the box.
Is this old school Nintendo?
Yeah. Take a look. See, there's Escape from Fairview
Road. Wow. This completely brings me back.
Yeah. You can see them in greater detail on our social media channels. So go follow it there, and at Tony B Pod on X or Twitter if you want to see those specifically. So there you go. Got to find humor in the darkness. Otherwise, there's no way in hell I think we could do this. So,
right.
So there you go. That's the latest on the Karen Reed trial. I'm sure we'll have more to talk about tomorrow.
Craving non-stop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. She was a doting mother, the kind who baked cookies, made the best homemade Halloween costumes, and never missed a PTA meeting. The perfect mom. Until the police found something buried in the backyard. A secret she kept for years. A secret she thought would never come to light. The neighbors gasped. Not her. She's so nice. But people forget. Monsters don't always look like monsters. Some wear aprons. Some tuck their kids in at night. And some hide their darkest deeds in places they think no one will ever look. If only someone had heard the warning signs, had recognized the patterns from an eerily similar case on Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. If they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened ad-free before anyone else and saved themselves from baking cookies with a serial killer. Instead, well, they won't be RSVP to this year's PTA meeting. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.